Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and it is time for the October episode of The Three Horsemen. Halloween is approaching, and we are getting into autumn and the tail end of the year, so we have lots and lots of things to go over. I want to welcome, as always, my two co-hosts. Say hello, John Stevens.
Yes. Hello. I'm a little... I'm a tiny, tiny bit slow tonight because I didn't get much sleep two nights ago, and last night I slept for like 10.5 hours, so it's been an odd day. But I am here, and I am I'm a writer and an occasional scribe for SF Signal, and I am on Twitter as EruditeOgre, and I do things on Tumblr, mostly showing off books that I have acquired, like the stuff that I got today that I may talk about, I guess, during the end of the show. And that's me.
That's always good enough, John. Say hello to Fred Kish.
Hi, this is Fred Kish. I'm at Fred Kish on Twitter, and I am trying to get rid of books rather than acquire books like John. But we never seem to be able to meet. And that's about it.
And I'm Jeff Patterson 11 on Twitter. I blog at Gravity Lens at Bad Day Studio. And I'm occasionally writing stuff for SF Signal. And I just got back from spending the weekend at Capclave, which was lots and lots of fun. I'll talk about that later. But tonight we have a guest fourth horseman again. Say hello to Greg Van Eekhout.
Hi, you said say hello to Greg Van Eekhout, but yeah. I guess here I am saying hello to myself. Hi, I'm Greg.
Hi, Greg. Greg's latest book, The Dragon Coast, came out last month, and we are here to talk about his stuff and other things that are going on in SF and fantasy right now. So this is the third book of the trilogy that all has the fancy matching covers and lots and lots of dark colors and bright contrasts and all those things that draw the eye to the book.
It's a pretty awesome design, actually. I was really, really happy. So the artist is Cliff Nielsen, who he also did the cover art for my first novel, Norse Code. And that was a different publisher, totally unrelated project, but I guess I got him again. And then I'm sure Irene Gallo at Tor was responsible for the design. They just look great. One of my favorite booksellers at Mysterious Galaxy, he made me like a slipcase for all three of them, so I could stick all three of them in the case, and it just looks awesome. Yeah, it's really neat.
Wow. When we had Irene on, she told us that once she thinks she's found a pair up of artist and writer, she tends to milk that puppy until it's dead. So
she works with some of the best artists. I love Tor's covers in general. I just do a fantastic job, because I've had some crappy covers. Give us
the morning talk show synopsis of what the book is about.
All right, it's a contemporary urban fantasy. It takes place largely in Los Angeles, although the other books kind of go north in various different parts of California. The basic idea is that wizards get their magical powers from consuming the bones, the remains of extinct magical creatures. So you eat a piece of dragon bone, and it imparts to you some of the abilities of that dragon. And in Los Angeles, there are the La Brea Tar Pits. That's a real thing. So in the middle of Los Angeles, there's like these lakes of tar that go back to the Pleistocene. And it's kind of cool because in the middle of the city around all these skyscrapers and stuff like that, there are like these really primordial oozing pits that contain the bones of mammoths and saber-toothed tigers and like extinct cave bears and that kind of thing. So I just thought, like, what would happen if in addition to those bones, you would also find the bones of griffins and unicorns and dragons and such. That was like the initial kernel of the idea. So the main character is an osteomancer, a bone wizard called Daniel Blackland. And he, when he was a child, his father was killed and dissected and partially eaten in front of him. Because if you're a wizard, you can get the bones, you can get the magic of a dragon by eating a dragon. If you eat a wizard who's eaten dragon bones, you get all that wizard's powers too. So his father was a pretty powerful osteomancer, and that's what got him killed. So the story skips forward about 10, 15 years, and Daniel is living under assumed identities because as the son of this powerful wizard, you know, there's a price on his head. So he's making a living just kind of by being a thief. He's got a little crew. They perform heists. And his crime lord uncle brings him in on this big job, and it's to go retrieve the last remains of his father's bones. And they happen to be sitting in the stronghold, the ossuary, of a guy called the Hierarch, who is the most powerful wizard in Los Angeles. And he's kind of the wizard king of the Kingdom of Southern California. And he's also the one who killed Daniel's father. So that sort of sets things into motion. And then the book ends, and then other stuff happens in Pacific Fire, and other stuff happens in Dragon Coast. You know, I was at a book signing at Borderlands, and I gave like the whole plots of all three books, and Shannon McGuire, I was signing with her, and Fran Wilde, and Shannon says, like, dude, don't spoil it. So she just told me, like, yeah, give the first book and then the second book, you know, more of the same, and the third book, more of the same.
That's funny. Well, if anyone was following Fred on Twitter, they've been following his progress with these books. I know he just wrapped up reading all of them.
And yes, I did. So first question that comes to mind is how many of the locations you use in the book or the books are real? I mean, I've never been to Los Angeles.
Okay.
Are there really canals everywhere, for example?
No, they're not canals everywhere. So most of the locations, what I would describe it as, they are real or they have a root in reality, and then I like to weird them up. Mm-hmm. So the canals are in a very, very small part of Los Angeles, just a small part of Venice, California, and they were built in the early 20th century.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But I weirded the canals. I extrapolated them so that instead of a street system and a freeway system, they have a canal system and elevated flumeways. A couple of reasons why I wanted to do that. First of all, I wanted to signal in a very dramatic, quick way that this is a very different Los Angeles. And the most dramatic thing you can do to make Los Angeles unlike how it really is get rid of the cars, get rid of the freeways. That's what so many people so closely associate with LA, is the traffic jams and the 405 highway and all that stuff. The story reason is because there's an alternative form of magic called hydromancy, which is basically water magic. And if you have any knowledge of not just history, but I guess current events in California, water is everything. There is no California without water. So it seemed weird to me that we would have a magic system, but we wouldn't have also this very powerful force of water magic, hydromancy. So William Holland, historically true, is the guy that brought water to Los Angeles, stole it basically from other places and other people. And in California Bones, he's still alive 100 years later, and he's the chief water mage of California. So that's kind of a subplot that provides like a sort of contrast to the bone magic and a tension against the bone magic.
And you've got a very interesting alternative history as well. I mean, there's sort of a United States, but California is separate, and California itself is separated into the Northern Kingdom, the Southern Kingdom. I mean, at what point does the world separate from what we have now into what you've come up with?
Well, I don't
like 1890s ish.
That's kind of my feeling. Again, it's an alternate reality. But it's not alternate history. Alternate history, it's like this is the breaking point at which one thing changed and things split off. And I wasn't playing that game in these books. Something happened, because if there is magic in the world, history is going to play out differently than it does in our world. And it's not like magic just sort of emerged at one point, so that's the breaking point. There's always been magic. I mean, if there are dragons in the world, if there were dragons in the world and extinct, the world is vastly, vastly different. So I kind of focus just on what's happening in California. There are two kingdoms, and that's largely because there are two hierarchs. There are two immensely powerful wizards, and their conflict is what led to each carving out a territory and those being sort of separate nation states. What's happening in the rest of the United States, I don't really care. I don't really go into that. I assume that there's wicked, weird stuff going all over the world. In California, there are trade relationships with other nations that have osteomancy. You know, they find frozen griffin carcasses, you know, in the steppes of Siberia.
Right.
Mexico certainly has osteomantic creatures. Japan, China, they have osteomantic creatures. So it's not that the rest of the world doesn't exist. I just didn't want to necessarily play out that entire historical line. And at one point, in the first draft, I actually did have references, more references to what was going on in the East Coast. And my editor and I together, we decided, like, you know what, that's just actually kind of muddying the story that you want to tell, which is this story about California.
See, I wasn't sure if the rest of the United States had magic or not, because they attacked California with, I think you mentioned, B-29s and Sherman tanks or something.
They have less magic because okay. They did not have the tar pits.
Mm-hmm.
They're not on the West Coast, so they do not have the trade relationships with other countries that have a great deal of osteomancy. Also, the other parts of the United States, they were settled earlier, and they had closer connections with Europe than California would. So they've been around longer and have used up more magic. Because the thing is, this magic, you know, if it's based on animal remains, it's a really finite resource. So the magic that they had has kind of been used up and dwindled over time. So that's why they kind of would have to have turned to more industrial and technological solutions and the magical solutions California turns to. See, I do have all this figured out.
So they've reached peak magic.
They have reached peak bone, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of saw this. You're almost making reference in a way to what California is going through right now with water resources.
Yeah.
Or us with oil, or you know, many other things. So I thought that was kind of amusing that, you know, magic is this declining thing. And it almost seemed like Southern California was managing it worse than Northern California. San Francisco looked a hell of a lot better than Los Angeles, it seems.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, I'm from Los Angeles. I love Los Angeles. You know, I'll defend Los Angeles, you know, to my last breath. But it's kind of a – can I say shit on this podcast?
Sure.
It's a sprawling shithole. I mean, Los Angeles really is. And compare it to San Francisco. San Francisco's got huge major problems. They really do. But it just seems like they're a little more together than Southern California. Southern California is a little bit more out of control. And, you know, I was conscious of the metaphor, the comparison between the dwindling magic and dwindling oil and dwindling water. And Northern California has more water than Southern California. Yeah, we love their water in Southern California here, and we'd like to have more of it. So I reason that Northern California probably has better trade relations with the Far East and with Russia than Southern California. So they're not as desperate for magic. They're not cannibals. The chief difference is in Southern California, that whole thing of eating other wizards to get their powers, that's rampant in Southern California. And in Northern California, it's anathema. It's not that it never happens, but it's not socially cool to go eating your colleagues as it is in Southern California.
Now, I thought one thing that was interesting was some of the words you've come up with. I mean, you've got an interesting mix of what seems to me made-up words and more traditional words from various cultures. Like, I mean, you've got golems.
Yeah.
But then you've got there's the one magic which causes you not to be seen, kind of an invisibility.
The Sinhalo, yeah.
Right, which seemed to be almost more of a made-up kind of thing.
No, that's a Native American mythological serpent.
Okay, well, that shows you what I know.
Yeah, and I was basically just drawing from all sorts of bestiaries and mythologies. And in my mind, the magical creatures that exist in these books aren't necessarily exactly the same as the mythological ones.
Mm-hmm.
The ones from mythology are mythologized versions of animals that actually existed. So My dragon would not necessarily correspond to a dragon from, you know, Norse mythology. It's similar. The Norse mythology one is a mythologized version of an actual real dragon. So a golem, it's probably a word that somebody in that world coined for something that's not actually the mythological Hebraic golem, but it's a metaphor. That word golem is a metaphor for what that magical construct in California Bones is.
Okay. So in reading these books, I was struck by a couple of things. I mean, I'm wondering, are you a gamer?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, role-playing, you know, paper, you know, you can admit to that. You know.
I think I'm the only one who, the only person I know of the thousands of people I've met in my life who's not a gamer.
Okay.
Neither am I, so.
Whoa.
Well, yeah, and nonetheless, we put up with him. Yeah. Two authors that came to mind, I mean, there's almost kind of a California feel in some fantasy. So are you a fan of either R.A. McAvoy or Tim Powers?
I've read a little McAvoy, and I devour Tim Powers.
Okay.
Tim Powers, to me, is one of the great, not just great fantasy writers of stuff that takes place in California. He's one of the great California writers. I mean, he should be talked about with Raymond Chandler, and he's fantastic. And when I was, you know, a mid-teen and found his books, just like nom nom nom. So, and you know, it's amazing. I was at a convention with Tim Powers, and it was supposed to be like a panel, but we were the only two panelists who showed up. So it turned into just sort of a conversation in front of an audience, which was amazing because, you know, I mean, like, I've got the total hero worship. But it's like, well, here's this dude, and he's just talking to me like as if he's a regular guy. And I told him my idea for California Bones, and he said, like, that's great. I want to steal that idea. And Tim Powers wanting to steal my idea is the hugest freaking compliment I have ever gotten. I actually just told him, like, you can have it. You can go ahead. It's yours. I give it to you. And he said, no, you know, because I don't know if he really thought it was that great an idea. But he's like, no, you go ahead and do it. But, man, Tim Powers wanted to steal my idea. That's freaking amazing. Mm-hmm. So, yes, yes, I am familiar with the works of Tim Powers.
Well, I picked up on that. There we go. It worked. Any other major influences?
God, this is the hardest question. I'm pretty much a sponge. There are not that many authors I can point to that I can see like a direct correspondence between what they did and how they influenced me.
Well, let me put it this way. Any even non-writer, because privately I was kind of jokingly calling the three books Ocean's 11, Ocean's 12, and Ocean's 13.
Yeah, well, I did a lot of I watched a lot of heist movies, and even more than that, I read a lot of news stories about heists to sort of get a feel for it. Like what the tropes are for heists and how heists actually kind of break down in real life. So, you know, Raymond Chandler, definitely an influence. Twilight Zone, definitely an influence. Stephen King, that's one that I could say, like, definitely the correspondence between what he did to my brain when I was a teenager and how I want my writing to sort of play out. But, you know, all sorts of weird stuff, you know, like Sesame Street yeah, just all sorts of weird stuff.
I'm kind of curious because we've talked about the various flavors of urban fantasy over the last couple of years, and I'm always fascinated when there's a new, you know, niche that can be carved out of it, because so often it looks like, you know, that the Indians have used every part of the corpse already. And so when I can see a new way of leveraging the concept and the tropes, it's interesting. And it's interesting because I haven't really thought that much about urban fantasy that is tied specifically to a geographic location. I mean, I remember when Walter John Williams did Metropolitan, where he talked about he wanted to do a completely urban fantasy to the point where the magic and the fantastical elements are tied specifically to the urban architecture and stuff like that, and how, you know, so the closer you are to a city, the more access to the magic resource you have. And there's been a few books that I've read that have really tried to, you know, tie aside from, yes, this is a holy place and stuff like that. But in constructing this type of an ecosystem, I mean, what's the germ for the idea when it comes to taking what's a natural resource or something that a lot of locals would actually take for granted and saying, yes, this is the font of all magic?
Well, the seed was the La Brea Tar Pits, which I don't know that there's anything really like it, at least on that scale, anywhere else in the world, really not in the middle of such a huge, like, metropolitan environment. It's a weird, if you go there, it's a weird thing. I mean, it's a weird thing to come across. It's endlessly cool, but it's a weird thing. And I guess I always wanted to write a La Brea Tar Pit story because it seemed like obvious, you know, like an obvious font for fantasy. And I don't know that anybody else has. And then everything kind of grew from that. And, you know, there's a lot of fast food restaurants and references to fast food places that actually exist in Los Angeles, because I wanted to take, like, you've got this weird fantasy element and you've got the current version of Los Angeles gets sort of drastically changed. But I also wanted to root it in some stuff that is canonically Los Angeles. And anybody who's been to Los Angeles or spent time there would probably recognize, like, the Tommy's chain of chili burgers and Roscoe's chicken and waffles and things like that. You know, I don't actually necessarily really, I mean, I'm not denying that these books are urban fantasy. I'm not saying, I'm not like being like, oh no, I don't write that. You know, it is urban fantasy, but I don't really think of it as such. Urban fantasy seems to me such a marketing term that coming at it as a writer, I don't want to come at my work from like where it's going to be shelved in the bookstore, you know, or the little imprint's going to say on the spine. I just want to tell stories in a world that seems cool to me, and urban fantasy seems to be where these stories fit. Mm. But, you know, I don't know what defines urban fantasy. Is it just fantasy that takes place in a city? You know, I mean, is Lord of the Rings urban fantasy? Because a lot of it takes place in Gondor. You know, there's a series of books by Deb Coates, Wide Open and Deep Down and Strange Country, and they're called urban fantasy, even though they take place in, like, you know, a very strongly and obviously rural environment. So it's just one of those things that I, you know, and when I was talking about tropes, I really wasn't talking so much about the urban fantasy tropes as much as the heist story tropes from thrillers and heist stories and, you know, movies like Ocean's 11. In terms of, like, urban fantasy tropes, I've read some urban fantasy that I like, but I don't really necessarily connect to any specific thing about urban fantasy that makes me say, like, yes, this is the kind of book I want to write. You know, I mean, so many of Ray Bradbury's good short stories, they take place in the 50s, but they take place in urban settings, and we don't call that urban fantasy. You know, it's just Bradbury. It's just fantasy. It's contemporary fantasy.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it's because that much of the more urban fantastic stories that occurred tended to fall into either Twilight Zone-y stuff or straight up horror.
Yeah.
And I think that when the whole idea of doing, you know, getting away from gangs of vampires running in the streets and actually bringing in full blown, you know, sequestering the non-horror components that make up a lot of fantasy, of using magic and sorcery and all the great, you know, ingredients that come from both epic and quest fantasy and stuff like that, and putting them into urban settings. I think that's where things started going running out, and that sort of turned into the whole, you know, girl looking over her shoulder with a sword on the cover, running around slaying demons and stuff.
I have one of those covers. North's cover is exactly that cover. I mean, precisely that cover. In every book out that year in 2009 had that cover. I think we might, I mean, this is what I don't know. I'm not a guru, but I'm hearing that the urban fantasy market is softening, so we might start hearing new terms for the same kind of stories. What happened in middle grade and YA is that there is no such thing as middle grade and YA science fiction, apparently. It's called future adventure or futuristic fantasy or dystopian. For some reason, the words science fiction on the back jacket of a YA or middle grade book is just not done. So there's plenty of stories that actually are science fiction. I mean, are inarguably science fiction, but that part of the publishing industry doesn't call it that. So if urban fantasy, if the market continues to soften, we'll probably see what would be called urban fantasy books, and they'll just call them something else.
Mm-hmm. John, anything? Are you too
well,
tired?
I mean, no.
He's still awake, man? He's still there?
If you start hearing the snoring, then get concerned. But, I was thinking about the urban fantasy thing. I think, you know, it's true that it's really mostly a marketing category. And the funny thing about, and I've only read the first of the three books, and I've read a bunch of your short stuff. My impression is, and like, I didn't even think of it as urban fantasy, really, because of the way you ground things and this sort of lack of sort of sensationalism about what's going on. It's magical and it's sort of wondrous and sometimes terrifying, but it's very serious and it feels really integrated. A lot of urban fantasy to me is not, because they're often doing it in secret, which they really couldn't do given what they end up doing sometimes. But I mean, I like the fact that you've integrated it. Really feels to me like just sort of modern fantasy. That's just how I would call it.
And I would just say that probably a lot of urban fantasy, with the girl and the sword looking over her shoulder, mm-hmm. probably does the same things or does other interesting things. But because mm-hmm. of the wrapper on it, people right. kind of assume like it's this thing, you know. And then that's okay. I mean, I think all that mm-hmm. packaging and stuff is just so that people who are looking for a certain thing can find a certain thing. And as a reader, I appreciate that. At the same time, there are people that, especially with my first book, Norse Code, pick it up thinking mm-hmm. that it was exactly that kind of book mm-hmm. and were confused and disappointed because it's like, well, you sold me this thing and this wrapper and it wasn't quite that.
Right. And see, that's why I often don't like those designators, because they sell the reader something that may not actually be in there.
Right. Right.
You know, I think it's partly sort of a personal preference for how you want to access your books, but
it's as if serial, like there was serial, but serial was so complicated and so weird that there wasn't anything that was quite serial. So when you open a cereal box, it's like, oh yeah, this is cornflakes. Like, oh, it's not exactly cornflakes. I wish it was cornflakes, or maybe I like this better than cornflakes.
Oh, now I want to take all the great fantasy cover tropes and start putting them into cereal boxes.
That'd be awesome.
Oh, wow. That'd be great.
Count Chocula looking over his shoulder, you know. Frankenberry with the big steampunk goggles up over on his forehead. And stuff.
He totally is steampunk. I mean, Frankenberry is totally a...
Yeah. No, that's kind of... It's weird because I feel the same way John does about that. It's you get a... I mean, and that's always been the case. I mean, I remember in the late 80s, there was a... I didn't read my first Mercedes Lackey until like she was, you know, several trilogies into her career, primarily because all those covers made it look like, oh, good Lord, we got another Shannara book coming out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't get into her stuff until later on. And part of it, I mean, I remember Harlan Ellison saying, you know, lumping her in with a lot of other, you know, wannabes that came out of the late 70s and early 80s and saying, yeah, a lot of it comes down to marketing and things like that. And I
but you know, they got to put a cover on it, and they got to put a picture on the cover. So I don't know, you know, I don't envy publishers with this immensely complicated task mm-hmm. of presenting a book. And there are readers who actually are, I mean, there are tons and tons of readers who actually want the exact kind of thing that the publishers are packaging it as. So
yeah,
it's a bit of conundrum. I just, you know, I get precious about my own books because I know how nuanced and complicated and twisted, you know, and it's like, well, it just looks like pretty much every other book. And I'm certain that every other writer is saying like, yeah, my book looks like a damn Greg Van Eekhout book. I'm doing stuff that's way more nuanced and interesting than that, you know? I mean, I hate those people, but I feel for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can see where it becomes, there was a period around, I think 2009, where almost every review that I read in either Black Static or Interzone, basically the whole first fifth of the review was what this book is not.
You know, it was, exactly
they had
right.
to identify it. They went out of their way to to do the service to the reader of saying, okay, this is not what you think it is from the cover, you know?
Yeah, I've had a lot of reviews like that. Yeah, the first thing they do is they deconstruct the package.
And, really?
Oh, yeah, no, that's like, well, certainly it happened with Norse Code. I mean, it's like, it looks like this, you think it's this, it's not actually this. And some of them were positive, like, yay, it's not actually that. And some were like, Fanny Cat, that moron, it's not actually that. I got ripped off. I'm like, wow. Well, go back to your bookstore. Get your $6.99 there back, fella. That's not my fault. I didn't paint the cover. I can't even draw hands. I'm not the one that's illustrating the cover.
We're going to the books are, you know, the books are going to go the way of like a lot of what's going on with the big comic companies, where every time there's a big comic, it comes out with six different covers, each one designed to appeal to a different sliver of the market, you know?
You know, I buy so many ebooks now that actually I find myself not paying that much attention to the cover.
Yeah.
At all. I mean, I couldn't even tell you what the cover of the last three books I read looked like. You know, I was going by reviews, I was going by friend recommendations. I read the excerpt and the cover just kind of, and that's sad because, I mean, book art is like, you know, such a cool thing. I would hate to think we're going to get to the point where it's just like, you know, a field of black and yellow letters and the title and the author and that's it. But it's interesting. We have to find different ways to sell books, and it was already super duper duper hard.
Hmm. Wow.
Right.
So you, we were talking off before the podcast, and I know this from following you on Twitter. I mean, you do a lot of author events, so that is part of selling. Is there anything that you like in particular? I mean, I think what is it? The most recent one you did cupcakes or something?
No, better than that. The most recent one we did tacos.
Oh yes, let's talk about the tacos. Yes.
Okay. Well, I live in San Diego. Tacos are very important to me.
Now the tacos for the event, were they from Tico's?
No, you're thinking Tito's Tacos. Tacos is a place in Los Angeles, and don't go out of your way to go to Tito's Tacos. They're a big part of my life. They shouldn't be a big part of anybody else's life. It's just that was like the local taco joint. So if you live in the west side of Los Angeles, you're probably familiar with Tito's, and it's like an institution because you went there as a kid and your parents went there when they were kids. But I mean, the tacos are kind of crappy there, actually. They're not great. I love them, but they're not great. I didn't actually do any book events for Dragon Coast. I did West Coast tours for the other two books. Dragon Coast only did two stops. Mm-hmm. And both of them were billed as Tacos and Takati, and Tour Books, my publisher, very generously had them catered. So the Borderlands, I don't know where those tacos came from. They were fine. At Mysterious Galaxy in San Diego, they came from Taco Surf. Now, Taco Surf to me is like as quintessentially San Diego as you can get, because A, tacos, and B, surfing. And you go inside and it's actually decorated with surfboards. It's like a surfboard museum. You see the history of surfboards just hanging on their walls and dropping down from the ceiling. And the thing about San Diego is like, that's not anything special. Every place is decorated with surfboards. But yeah, and there was like a familial connection between the bookstore and the guy that runs Taco Surf. And they were fantastic. And they also had like enchiladas and they had guacamole. And we had craft beer from a Green Flash Brewery, a local craft beer place. So those two events were by far the most fun I've ever had at events, because you put tacos and beer in a bookstore and people show up. It's like you say you're going to get free beer. You're going to get free tacos and you're going to get free beer. And you don't even have to buy a book. All you have to do is show up, sit down, politely listen to people yabber, blah, 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 blah. Here's my book, buy my book. And you get tacos and beer. So that was the most fun I've ever had at book events. I've also done cupcakes, which I guess was okay. And I brought pizza. You know, I usually do this for like the book launch, and it's usually at Mysterious Galaxy, which is my hometown, because it's kind of like, I feel like it's not just a book event. I'm kind of throwing a little bit of a party. And so it was great if Tor to actually spring for the tacos and beer. That's a really good thing about Tor.
Now, you've moved on with this book to, I mean, these three are pretty much adult fantasy.
Yeah.
But in the past, you've done whatever term you want to use, more aimed towards younger readers. So what's your approach with interacting them? I assume no tacos, no beer.
I don't know. Beer. Kids, this generation. Yeah, it's middle grade. Middle grade is the category in terms of age. It's right below YA, so it tends to be defined as books for, there's a little wiggle room, but 9 to 12. Sometimes it goes down to 8, sometimes up to 13 or 14. But it's basically those for the upper elementary school, lower junior high or middle school. I've written 2 middle grade books, Kid versus Squid and The Boy at the End of the World. And I love it. The reason why I did it, the first one, is I had submitted Norse Code and I thought, it's not going to sell. Nothing's going to happen. I'm going to have to change my name. I'm going to have to reboot my career. And I didn't want to think about what was going to happen to the book out of it once it was out of my hands. I mean, that's where neuroses come from. So the thing I decided to do is I would just bury my face and write a book. Write in a different age category. And so it turned out, it's my first middle grade attempt, that it was a hoot. It was absolutely, writing is hard. It's always hard and it's often aggravating, but I've never had more fun writing a book than when I wrote those 2 middle grade books. I love the audience for those. Here's the thing, with like an adult book, somebody loves your book and that feels great, or they hate your book and that feels like crap. Kids are so passionate and they just aren't that experienced yet. So if they love your book, they love it with every cell of their being. I've had so many kids say, like, you're my favorite author and this is the best book I've ever read. And I'm like, well, okay, it's like the only book you've ever read and I'm the only author you know. So, but for this week, that is a true part of your life and that's great. Don't read any other books. That's my recommendation to them. Like, stop now. So it's great. And I see myself bouncing back and forth between adult and middle grade for the rest of my life. Career-wise, I don't know if it's that smart because, you sort of leave part of your audience behind for a while. When you switch age groups, they don't necessarily cross over. But I'm willing to sort of sacrifice that career savvy for the satisfaction I get writing both kind. When I started California Bones, I just my last book had been The Boy at the End of the World, one of the middle grades. The first chapter, I could not stop typing the F word because I hadn't been allowed to do it for the previous 2 books. So every third word was the F word, to the extent that I was like offended. I was just like, wow, okay. So there is a difference. They're not the same in some ways, but you're still bringing the same sort of sense of what a story is and what it's supposed to do and how a story works. And you're still bringing your own like quirks and eccentricities and obsessions and stuff. That part is pretty much the same, no matter what age group you're writing for.
So are you a plotter or a pantser?
Used to be a pantser, was a pantser. And then one day in a 72,000 word book, I realized I'd pantsed myself into such a corner that I had to toss out 35,000 words of it. Ouch. And after that, I've been an outliner. Yeah. And my outlines get more elaborate and tighter with every book. Outlining, I mean, people act as if it's just a choice. You decide, oh, I'm going to be a pantser. I'm going to be an outliner. Learning to write an outline that's not just arbitrary. It's not just like, oh, I need 30 chapters of stuff happening. And so I don't know what happens in chapter 7. So I'll just, type something that happens in chapter 37. It's actually a whole nother set of writing skills and disciplines of being able to foresee your story and see how it's taking shape and plan that. I mean, I wanted to be an outliner from the very beginning, but I'd outline the first 100 pages and then I'd be like, I don't know what happens next. How could I possibly know what happens next? I haven't written it yet. So it's a learning process. And the more I learn how to do it and the more I outline, generally speaking, the less hair I pull out of my skull as I'm in the writing process. Because 35,000 words, getting rid of that was a bad day. That was a bad day. There might have been some tears at the Starbucks in front of everybody. Might have been a little profanity and some stares from neighboring tables. I'm like, screw you, I'm writing a book here. You don't know what it's like. Shut up.
And everybody else in the Starbucks yells, so am I.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Get in line.
They have an entire dustbin in the back of the Starbucks, which is all the words that people have ripped out of their books. And
if we could recycle those bits and bytes, we would have enough computer power to to us.
Wow, that's.
But, my main message is that writing stinks. It stinks. Writing is horrible. It's It's awful, and I don't know why anybody does it, but it's fantastic. It's amazing. It's wonderful. I can't believe that I get to do this, and it's horrible.
Well, you're really selling the industry to my...
I think people need to know the truth.
No, true.
Yeah. What are you working on next?
Well, it's very, very early days, so I can't go into it too much, but I'm working on a middle grade science fiction novel, and it involves dogs. And also I'm working on a proposal for something that follows up the Daniel Blackline trilogy that's like it enough that people that liked the trilogy will like this one, but not so much like it that if nobody wants any more books in the trilogy, that I'll be sunk. It's still possible I'll write more Daniel Blackland books. I mean, it's in terms of sales, you know, we probably should collect more data, and then I should talk to my editor or my publisher and see what they want. Mm-hmm. But I'm always trying to, once I finish a project, I'm trying to do something different so I don't have to think about how the project is doing commercially on the market. I think a lot of writers fall into that trap. They release a book, and then instead of working on the next book, they're looking at their Amazon sales numbers of the book that's already out. And it's like, well, now you're 2 years behind in your career because you need to be working on the next one, you know, probably 2 years in advance.
Hmm. Yeah, we've had a lot of people talk about the fact that cycle sort of breaks up their mindset when they're in the middle of one project and suddenly they're promoting, you know... They're promoting their brain from 2 years ago, and they have to, you know, go through the files and dig out everything that happened back.
Oh, it's hard. Sometimes people ask me questions about my books, and I'm like, is that in my book? I don't even remember that. I just saw a complaint that Gabriel from California Bones in my book is 20 years old, and I'm like, no, he's not. And like, did I actually write that he's 20 years old somewhere? I don't even remember. You know, I don't think he's only 20 years old, but I could be wrong. It's been a while since I've written and read that book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I got through the third one. I was very disappointed. It was not the tamale scene saved it because you had no tacos, and I was very disappointed.
Yeah, I have a friend of mine who's really actually, I think she's legitimately angry. She's like, you need to write, like, you know, the deleted scene and put it online of them eating tacos. So I might have to. I don't know.
Now, what are those hamburgers that are featured in, I think, book two, Real Thing? The one character's restaurant serves a certain kind of hamburger? Or,
yeah,
actually,
yeah.
Book one, he makes the circuit between the various restaurants.
It is, yeah. There's Original Tommy's, which is a chili place, chili burgers and chili... chili burgers and chili dogs on Rampart in Los Angeles. And then there's Tom's number 5 and Tom's number 3 and Tom's number 7. Tommy's with just one M, Big Tommy's. And there's sort of these like kind of vaguely, tenuously connected burger joints all up and down Southern California. And it's a very particular flavor of chili. It's very orange. It's orange. It's orange. And they're god awful. They're horrible, but they're so delicious. They're so good. Just thinking about it, honestly, just thinking about it, I know it takes me exactly 20 minutes to get to the closest Tommy's variant. And I'm after this podcast, I might go because they are addictive.
Because in New York, we've got all these Ray's, Original Ray's, Real Ray's. Famous
same
original
thing. Same thing. Same deal.
Just horrible pizza but more like grease than anything else.
Yeah, well, Tommy's has that going for it. Like, yeah, it's orange, and a large part of the orange is liquid. It's but it's so good. Oh, God. It's so good. And the guy that eats those has a peculiar magical ability.
Yes, he does.
Right, because he was fed a lot of Hydra bone. You know, Hydra is the serpent. You cut off its head, and another one grows in its place. So it makes sense that Hydra remains convey some sort of generative or healing abilities. And he's had a lot of that. He's almost unkillable. So he can eat all these horrible, wonderful, chili, slobby things and does not have to worry about arterial sclerosis. So he's got the best power in the books.
Yes, I've always described our relationship with food as being somewhat abusive on the part of the food. I used to be heavily addicted to wasabi peas, and nothing good can come from that. You know, it's heartburn and shrapnel in your teeth, and everything burns and it hurts, but you keep eating them.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, how are your office mates doing?
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, my two office mates are my dogs, Dozer. He's a Yorkie, Jack Russell, and Amelia. She's terrier mix and maybe some corgi and a bunch of other BS. God only knows. And they're like Tommy's chili burgers. They're awful. They're awful, but I love them. Amelia's pretty much housebroken, except for this week. Some kind of switch turned on where she's decided, like, yeah, I'm a dog who poops on the living room carpet now. That's who I am. Yeah, I'm just going to look right at you and like, yeah, I'm pooping on the living room carpet. That's what I do now. I'm a dog. That's who I am. So we're dealing with that. She hid under the bed today for about 20 minutes because I was vacuuming, which pretty much just tells me I don't do enough housework because she's like, what fresh robotic hell is this? I was like, you wouldn't recognize this. It's a vacuum cleaner. We actually have one in the closet. It doesn't come out that often. So I'm going to expose you to it more often.
Oh, my.
They're good dogs. They're, my wife has a regular day job, and she works pretty long hours, and I work at home. And if I don't, you know, go out to have lunch with another writer friend, which I do every now and again, or I don't go to a coffee joint, I can literally sit here by myself for many, many hours and not utter a single word. And it's weird. Mm-hmm. So then I found myself taking walks and I would be talking to myself, not realizing it. It's like, you know what you need, Greg? You need a damn dog. So I went and got a damn dog. And now I can talk to myself and walk the neighborhood. And it's cool because everyone's like, oh, he's talking to his dog. Isn't that cute? So they're kind of like my human credential. They're what justify me being out in public. I get fewer suspicious looks.
You just get a fake Bluetooth headset.
That's a thing. I know. It's like that used to be the tell. Somebody talking to themselves. It's like, okay, well, there's an issue there. And so I should be aware. I should be alert. That was the tell. And now we've been robbed of that tell. So yeah. People talk to themselves. I don't know. You know, I mean, the conversations of people engaged in business conversation and people with a mental illness sound exactly alike.
They do. They do.
There's no difference.
There's a short story, I forget who wrote it, the time travelers that go back in time and they're all talking on headsets implanted in their ears, and the last one gets picked up, but he's wondering why one by one they're all dropping off the network, and it turns out the cops are picking them up because they're walking around talking to themselves.
And it sounds lunatic, like, oh, it's spreadsheets and quarterly reports. And it's like, these aren't natural combinations of words that should have evolved in language naturally. We live in a very strange era.
Yes.
So I don't care if you're in, like, you know, a $2,000 suit. If you're talking to yourself and I don't understand the words you're saying, it's going to prick my ears up a little bit.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's so funny. Oh, man. Excellent. Excellent. Well, gents, you want to talk about what we've been sticking our noses in lately?
Sure.
John, how about you? You've been too quiet.
Okay. as I said at the start, just as an aside, I went to the local library book sale. Which is one of the largest book sales, I believe, either in the U.S. or North America. They have a dedicated warehouse, and they have a twice-yearly book sale. It's just some years, you know, it's not that good. I mean, because they're, of course, like every other kind of, you know, thing like that, they're totally at the mercy of what books people bring them. But since I live in a town with two, you know, major colleges and a whole bunch of graduates of those colleges who stayed, there are a lot of books flown around. And, so I got up at 3 a.m. yesterday and I got in line with about, I think at the end, I was number 42. And we waited hours in the cold and then we got our tickets and then we went in and bought lots of books. And, I found a lot of good stuff. Stuff I'm going to put on my reading list pretty quickly. But the coolest thing I think I got were the, I got the first issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction,
Ooh.
Boom. When it was called the Magazine of Fantasy. And I got the FNSF with the first printed story of Philip K. Dick. Ooh. That was pretty cool. And I got a couple of issues of, I've sort of only heard this magazine sort of rumored about in whispers, the Avon Fantasy Reader.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at the cover and I was like, there's a woman being chased by a space Roman. but when I looked inside, I saw that the table of contents was like Clark Ashton Smith and, you know, just like sort of a who's who of, you know, weird writers. And I was just kind of blown away. So
did
I grabbed a couple of those.
But did you get the most famous issue?
Which one's the most famous?
Scanners Live in Vain. Scanners. Or Wayne Smith.
Oh, I don't know if I got that one or not.
Oh, you better check.
if I got issues 16 and 17.
I don't remember which one it was.
Because I was kind of going fast, because one of the things about the first day is you're limited to only 50 books at a time.
Ooh.
So, only 50.
Only 50. You can only buy 50, then you have to go out and come back in.
Oh, man. I'm picturing the express lane, you know, 50 books are left.
Exactly. And because on the first day, a lot of dealers are there and really dedicated book fans.
Yeah.
You don't linger very long at any particular point. You sort of scan around and move and scan around and move. So, but I may go back. It goes on for a month of weekends. So I may go back next weekend and see what's left of this. Someone just donated a huge pile of old, you know, SFF magazines to them from the 40s and 50s, and that's where this stuff came from. So, and they were $5 a piece, which was kind of cool. So those are all going to be some culture I'm going to definitely consume. As for what I've read since our last meeting, Aidan Moore's short story collection, Sides of Shadows.
Ooh.
Which, you know, full disclosure, the author sent me a copy. It was okay. It wasn't, there was an undertone to the writing that seemed like it was trying to treat the stories gently. And that diluted some of the emotional impact of what was happening in the stories. Maybe that's sort of a beginner's, you know, tick or something. But a couple of the stories I thought were really good. There was a great, I think the best one was probably, what was it called? The Girl of, hold on a second, I'm going to find that. Here we go. Was a story called The Girl with Wings of Iron and Down. That I think was probably the best story in the collection. And I think it's worth picking up because I think it shows some promise. And despite that sort of feeling that things were being kind of undercut a little bit, I like that they're not the most straightforward stories. He sort of tries to come around about to an ending, and they're not very predictable. And they don't easily resolve. And I think that was some of the good parts of his writing in general. And I also, what else did I finish? Oh, I read Teresa Fraxa's In Midnight Silence. I finished that off.
Yeah, you mentioned.
And that was good. It was good. I think the only big complaint I really have is that it was too short. It's a novella basically. And it was too short because you would just start getting a real firm awareness of a scene or what's going on in a character's head, and it would move along. So it just seemed to move a little too fast. And part of the reason that that's annoying is that you want to know more about the characters, because she's really trying to make, you know, intriguing characters here for you to follow along with. And she's dealing with things like, you know, immortality and sort of this sort of high-level, you know, fight between angels and daimons. And it would be interesting to get more of the characters, you know, in that struggle. And that ends up being a little light because the story kind of moves along pretty fast. The only other thing that I didn't like was that the villain was a little too of a mustache twirly bad guy for me. but the main characters that you follow are pretty interesting. I really like what she's, I think, going to do more with later with the relationship between one of the main characters, Diago, and his newly found son. She did a really good job characterizing the child. I thought that was actually he may be one of the best, I think, best characters in the story. And it was fun. It was fun to read.
On my list.
Yeah. I went back and reread some Warren Ellis. I reread No Hero.
Ah.
And then I had to go read Black Summer again to compare them.
Yes, because they came out back to back.
And there are some really glaring similarities.
Yeah.
Because they're both about, you know, these sort of unique super teams who are formed and how things turn out is not what you would expect, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess more so in No Hero. Although I didn't... I think, again, for me, No Hero went at the end a little too fast, and I wanted a little more development to really understand what was going on.
Yeah.
And then, without trying to spoil it, I think Ellis had a main character withhold information he should have imparted to the newcomer before he turned him into a superhero.
Yeah.
Like, very important information that he probably should have had.
Yeah.
Before they made him super powerful. But I like Ellis's writing a lot, and I like what he does. He doesn't always succeed, I think, but he really does try to put a different spin on things and try to create much more grounded narratives than you see in a lot of superhero stories. And you know, I like the way he twists the knife sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Where some authors will go off into satire, essentially. Ellis just kind of follows the implications of what's happening. To an extreme point that they could certainly go in, and just haven't been utilized very often. So I like that a lot too. I am still reading Letters to Tiptree, which is fun. Oh, and then Black Summer. I read Black Summer in contrast because in some ways they're very similar. Yeah. And while I think there are parts of No Hero I like a lot, I think Black Summer is the better story.
I think Black Summer had a better backstory.
Yes, yes, definitely.
All of the flashbacks in Black Summer are
very effective. It was very effective.
The best parts, and you're like, ooh, I really want that to be the...
Right. I would like that. Where's that story? Yeah, so I mean, just reading Black Summer, it felt more cohesive and more... And it really kept my attention more. Yeah. But No Hero was good. It was fun. You know, of course, him when he and Rip get together, human bodies get really, really ripped up in very bizarre ways. Yeah.
There's a bit of a Jeff Darrow detail that goes into
But Rip is a really good artist.
He is.
I mean, he's got a really good level of detail. The style is very distinctive, and he's not trying to be hyper realistic, but you feel very much like, you know, this is solid. It's solid. It's not. It doesn't feel too cartoony. It doesn't feel, even when unbelievable things happen, it doesn't feel too unbelievable because of his art style. Just,
yeah,
you know, just really, really nice, really well done. And then I don't know. I'm reading a few things that are in progress, and I think that's about it for me for this one.
Wow. Yeah, I just the volume one of Injection just came out in trade, and reread that. It was still fairly fresh in my mind, and seeing a lot of stuff that you mentioned about Ellis and the way he does a very good job of weighing the impact of things, and that came to play.
It did.
Excellent.
Oh, and I was hoping to finish the first collection of Bitch Planet before the show, and I did not. But
is the trade out?
No, I got it early.
Oh, okay. All right.
And I haven't read the single issues, so I'm coming to it just sort of knowing the reputation.
Ooh,
I've literally just read like the first issue, basically, but I definitely want to go on. I'm definitely liking what's going on.
Yeah, that'll definitely be a discussion because I still got to catch up, and I had a couple issues with it, but I am curious. Mm-hmm. It was a neat little idea.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Nice. Yeah.
Ooh, let's talk to our guest. Greg, you said you read a couple books.
I did. Well, okay, I'm going to give you one book and one movie. So,
okay.
The movie, I caught it on an airplane, so it's been out a while. It was The Woman in Gold. It's a true story, and it's about a woman's attempt to get back a painting, the famous painting, A Woman in Gold by Gustav Klimt, which is like considered the Mona Lisa of Austria. To get it back after it was basically stolen from her family by the Nazis. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because Helen Mirren, of course, is Helen Mirren, so she's always amazing and fantastic. But Tatiana Maslany plays the younger version of her. And, you know, I've seen Tatiana Maslany, of course, on Orphan Black, so I've seen her play, 406 different characters because she plays all the clones in Orphan Black. So to see her in a different role was interesting, and it did not really dawn on me until the end of the movie that she did the entire movie speaking German. She did it so naturally and smoothly that I kind of forgot that she was actually speaking in a language that Tatiana Maslany probably doesn't actually speak natively. So if you're an Orphan Black fan, I would go seek it out just for her performance alone. For books, I just yesterday finished a middle grade novel, middle grade science fiction, even though it's not called science fiction, Fuzzy Mud by Lewis Sachar. It's a story basically about a disease outbreak. Scientists have developed a new form of biofuel, and it's mutated and started to spread as these kind of disease outbreaks do. And it's probably aimed at maybe a 10 to 12-year-old reader. What I kind of like about it is it raises some interesting issues of what we are willing to risk to ourselves, our health, and our environment, and what we are willing to sacrifice to get cheap, clean energy. Green energy, cheap, clean energy is something that we all want, but it's not like you can just have one great thing without having some kind of impact or consequence on another thing, often unforeseen. So I thought it was a good basic story that sort of it's going to get young readers thinking about some of these pretty complex issues. And it's also just, it's a school story, you know, it's also about friendship and bullying and that sort of thing. It's kind of science fiction that I wish they would just call science fiction, because it's the kind of thing, if you know it's science fiction, you can give to a young reader and say, you know, here, have some SF. You might like this. And that can start a whole, interesting cluster bomb of cool things. That's what I got.
Wow. I didn't. Well, who wrote that?
Lewis Sachar. He's most known for writing the book Holes,
yeah,
which was also the movie Holes. He's awfully prolific. I think this is just his latest one.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't seen a slow apocalypse aimed at the younger reader.
Yeah, and it's very local. You know, it's local to this school, to the woods behind the school, and basically to these three kids. So it's not like one of these things where every chapter, like this chapter, takes place in a lab in Helsinki. You know, and this chapter takes place like at a casino in Monaco. It's local, and the story is short and it's contained. And I think especially there's the concept of the reluctant reader, which are kids that don't generally like to read, or that we aren't finding them the right books. I think this is one of those books that you give to a reluctant reader, or you give to a reader that you think might like science fiction.
Hmm. Wow. All right.
Neat.
Fred, I'm afraid to hear where you are right now.
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but I really am not much further than I was last month.
Oh.
Short works, 726. Books, 116. The only three books I finished, believe it or not, since last month were the three books by our guest.
I got in the way.
I'm reading a lot of stuff. I'm in progress on a lot of stuff, like Zeroes by Chuck Wendig, a really big fat book on the Vietnam War called The 13th Valley. I mean, I'm reading a lot of nonfiction, but, you know, as usual, I'm reading 50 books at once and haven't finished anything recently. short works, I read a couple of Delaney essays from about writing. And I today, after finishing Greg's book, I sat down and read like three or four Sherlock Holmes stories from this big collection I've been working through in a row, which were fun because Holmes is always fun. And I actually found an actual usage of the games afoot. As a quote-unquote Holmes scholar told me once, that was never actually used in any of the stories, just in the movies. And I'm like, wait a minute, here it is right here. So it's like... So much for that scholarship.
Lies.
Yeah, exactly. In other...
The Christmas special's out, too.
Yeah, that's coming. I'm looking forward to that for Sherlock. In other areas, as a family, we're still working our way through X-Files. We're in season 4 right now. We go through like 2 episodes a weekend. And also as a family, we also went to see on opening day The Martian. Which we all three enjoyed a lot. So I was very happy that my wife, who had not read the book, enjoyed it. My daughter, who this is like almost the only quote-unquote adult science fiction she's ever read, other than all the comics that she's just burning through. this is the only adult science fiction book she's ever read, really, and she enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed it. So highly recommended. Oops. It's a good thing my speaker's not on because Mocha would go nuts with that. And that's as far as I've gotten.
Wow. Well, it's funny you mention that because I was up at Capclave this weekend, and the guests were Gordon Van Gelder of Fantasy and Science Fiction, which we mentioned, and Alistair Reynolds. And Alistair Reynolds gave a little brief history of Mars in SF, based on the various, breaking it into periods based on the scientific knowledge that was known of the planet at the time. And he talked a little bit about The Martian. He had not read the book, if I remember correctly, but he talked about the movie and how it part of it reminded him of bits from Martian Odyssey, minus the actual canals and feel and all that stuff. So. It was a good con, though. I had a really good time. I got to chat with Bud Sparhawk and Lawrence Schoen. I had a very long conversation with Kate Baker from Clark's World, talking about audio and podcasting and stuff like that. And I got to chat with a few people I don't get to see all that often. And I said hello to AC Wise on the first night, but I didn't get back to talk to her. And I really wanted to because the story that she has in Clark's World I really liked. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was my first con in a while, and I had a grand time at it. And they did a very good job running it this year. Reading. Well, I had talked earlier this year about rereading Will McCarthy's Bloom and Linda Nagata's, Nanotech Succession books. And I sort of found myself falling back into a late 90s, widescreen SF mode for a bit. And so I found a copy at one of the book sales that I went to. I found a copy of Cave of Stars by George Dabrowski, which was the sequel to Macro Life. Mm-hmm. It was the sequel he wrote 20 years later to Macro Life. And so that was really good. I Zabrowski's one of the writers that always tends to slip under my radar once in a while. And I'm probably going to read all of Omega Point again now after having read it. The other thing I read in that groove while I was there was I never read the last two books of the Neverness Quartet by David Zindel. I'm down in the Z's right now this month. So I read The Wild and War in Heaven, and wow, yeah, I had forgotten how good of a little universe he built there. I've got a couple issues with a few of the storylines that run through it, but yeah, definitely worth it. It probably could have been 3 books, but it's fine at 4 books. I'm good with it. I hit a couple of big book sales, and at one of the ones I went to at George Mason University for 50 cents, I found a copy of Wandering Stars, edited by Jack Dan, which was the Jewish fantasy and science fiction anthology. I found a copy of it at Capclave going for 20. So, so I read that, read most of it. The Pamela Sargent story, of course, I'm still on my Pamela Sargent kick, but there's a William Ten story in there that I never read either, which is really good. On a similar note, I just started reading, Lavi Tidar and Rebecca Levine have a, anthology out called Jews versus Aliens. I think there's also a Jews versus Zombies as well.
Yep.
They put together, and I just started, I'm sort of going through some of the stories back and forth. The story Excision by Naomi Alderman, though, I really liked. A couple comics I want to talk about. Number one, Lauren Bucus has a first issue of her horror comic, Survivors Club, is out with Dale Halverson and Ryan Kelly doing the art. Dale Halverson's the co-writer. Neat little idea about all of these lone survivors of various horror things that went on in the past, all from different cultures and different backgrounds, are sort of brought together because there's a video game that's coming out that seems to be tweaking the minds of people who have undergone supernatural horror things. So, you know, sort of picture, this is the back of the envelope thing, sort of picture of like the last survivor of Freddy Krueger and the last survivor of the Ring movie and stuff like that, all basically sort of got together because something weird is going on. However, there was this one thing that it did where it sort of started calling out these flashbacks where we were seeing what happened to these people when they first experienced the supernatural. And it had a real distinct vibe similar to Sense8, the miniseries Sense8 that was on. And it kind of, it was a touch too heavy-handed, but still it was pretty good. The story's a little convoluted because she dumped so many characters in all at once, but I'm really interested in seeing where this thing goes. I think the first issue could have probably used another 10 pages to get it really played out. Image continues knocking first issues out of the park. I think I've talked probably about 20 different issue number ones that have come out this year so far. The two that really got me going, the first one is called From Under Mountain. It is written by Claire Gibson. The art is by Sloan Leong, I believe it's pronounced. Nice kind of a Silk Road fantasy. Nah, not quite. It's full-blown Middle Eastern fantasy. Of a secondary Arab setting. And the first issue seemed to be mostly putting pieces on the playing board, but I'm really interested in all the pieces, and I'm really interested in the playing board. Once again, I sort of miss the days when comics had a double-sized first issue because you really got, you know, thrown in the deep end, and I really think that would benefit a lot of books coming out. The other one that came out, this was a complete surprise to me because I had not even known this was coming out. Brian K. Vaughan has a new comic called Paper Girls, and the first issue came out last week. The art is by Cliff Chang, and it is about a girl who is starting her paper route on November 1st, 1988, the day after Halloween. And she meets up with the other girls who deliver papers in the neighborhood, and girls delivering newspapers is a brand new thing at the time. And they have a run-in with the local bullies, and the run-in with the local cops, and a run-in with these strange, mysterious figures that are running around the neighborhood doing something odd. And they find something very creepy and distinctly science fictional in the basement of this one abandoned model home in the neighborhood that they're delivering in. I'd almost say it's guilty of decompression because it all takes place over the course of like maybe a couple hours, but it's so rapid that you cannot call this at all decompressed. Vaughn is really good at giving you the broad strokes of his characters in only a few lines. And in this book, much more so than in Saga, the artist really does a lot of the heavy lifting when it comes to establishing the characters, their facial expressions, their poses. Given the fact that there's four main protagonists that we have by the end of the book, the fact that he paints them all pretty well in such a short duration, you know, span of time page wise, because once again, this is, you know, it's a single issue of a book. It's 22 pages. And the fact that he nails it with an ending that's going to, you know, raise eyebrows and go, I wonder where this is going. Once again, this is it. It opens with a very extended, really trippy dream sequence that I think bodes ill for a lot of the characters. But yeah, highly recommend. It was the surprise of the week. And I read it and was blown out of the water by it. So I'm hoping for more of that. I've been watching the Guardians of the Galaxy cartoon too. Anyone been watching that?
No.
Yeah. It's such a valiant attempt. It really is. First of all, they went right out of their way to say that Quill's father is Spartax, which is keeping with the comics, but I thought they were going to try to keep his father's origin a mystery for the movies, so I'm kind of curious about that. Really good use of all the characters, but a lot of, in very similar to the latest Avengers cartoon, a lot of really pat responses, and the humor is kind of heavy-handed. So I'm a little... I got one episode sitting on the DVR I haven't watched, but the first two-parter was kind of neat. They actually did do something from the Dan Abnett run of the original Guardians of the Galaxy comic from a while back. But yeah, it's a valiant attempt, but I really hope they pulled this together because it looks gorgeous and it's a neat little amalgamation of CGI and animation that looks like traditional cell animation. I'd really, and Cosmo from the comic is in it quite a bit, and that alone makes me very happy, and that's the thing that keeps me coming back to it, because I need more Cosmo. So we'll see. I have high hopes, but given how the last Avengers cartoon was so disappointing, I'm gritting my teeth as I go in. So, and that's about all I got. So, that's
pretty good.
Yeah. So, Greg, thank you for being on. This was wonderful.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me. This is it's been a lot of fun. I'm always like very grateful when people let me open my mouth and yabber at them, whether on a podcast or just like, you know, in a diner. So, thanks.
Yeah, we tend to be. We've had a few. Episodes that have gone off the rails. So
is this one of them? I hope this is one of them.
I don't think we ever actually start on the rails, to be honest with you.
No. There are no rails.
No, there are no
rails. Just like Back to the Future, there are no roads.
Yeah. No, this is great. I'm kind of sorry. One question here, when you were talking about length, one thing I've been noticing in a lot of series that I've been reading is that I'm finding more and more series. It used to be that as the later books in the series went, the books started getting longer. And then I started noticing, I think the last actual trilogy that I read that was brand new, I found that the third book was like the shortest of them all. And I was like, that's really weird. I've never seen that happen before. And I'm just kind of wondering, did you have to struggle with, I mean, I know you talked about cutting stuff out, but did you have an idea for length in these books when you went into them?
No, I mean, I think they're all three a little bit shy of 80,000 words, which was kind of overall where I felt they should be, just based on like, you know, how big the story was. Mm-hmm. And my editor was kind of comfortable with that, but I didn't have any really like word restrictions or limits. I think, you know, if I turned in 150,000 word books, they would have said like, hey, that's weird. But no, it's just kind of came out naturally this way. And yeah, it does seem to me that there's size creep. Yeah, I haven't seen that often where they kind of get shorter as the series goes on. I think if they get shorter as it goes on, that might be indication of the writer running out of steam or time. So.
Or it being artificially broken into a trilogy when it could have
been. Yeah, which is just, my heart bleeds for people that have that done to them.
Yeah, I hear that, because we're seeing a lot of stories there. Their links being, well, I mean, that's the one thing that's nice about ebooks too, is that you get much less of a, you know, the the physical restriction. I mean, if you go to a bookshelf and you see all these big, thick, Sanderson books, and then right in the middle, there's this nice slim little volume. It sort of, looks like a wallflower there, but sometimes that's the best stuff is. So, awesome. Great.
Sad and puny. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is great. I hope everybody has an excellent Halloween, and we are going to be back in November with more stuff for you. So until then, I hope everybody has a good evening.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.